news when you want it. Get the latest headlines with the Bloomberg News Now podcast.
The latest developments in the war in the Middle East.
Inflation relief for consumers.
The top headlines from Bloomberg News, updated continuously throughout the day.
All in less than 5 minutes.
The House and Senate passing that spending bill.
Tesla's support among Wall Street bulls is weakening.
Get the latest news when you want it at the click of a button.
Now to the latest on the race for president.
Listen on Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Business App.
And anywhere you get your podcasts. Bloomberg News Now. Context changes everything.
The whole world is talking about the new tariffs from the White House.
This is not the act of a friend.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, why some believe that global trade as we've known it is over.
It was the United States driving globalization and supporting U.S.-led multilateral institutions.
This feels to me like the end of the liberal international economic order that I've lived through my whole life.
We also go to Ukraine today and meet chaplains who work on the front line.
Be a human being. We cannot be strong every time.
And to Khartoum to hear what's left of the city after 2 years under siege.
Plus, scientists find life thriving beneath the ice, even in places with no sunlight.
So we're expecting some life, but not what we found.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The will he, won't he wait is over. Yesterday, President Trump announced sweeping new tariffs on countries around the globe. He said it's time to stop what he called the, quote, looting, pillaging, raping, and plundering of the United States.
The tariffs and the president's language provoked worry, dismay, and threats of countermeasures worldwide. European Union President Ursula von der Leyen urged the international community to be prepared for the likely consequences of the levies.
The global economy will massively suffer. Uncertainty will spiral and trigger the rise of further protectionism. The consequences will be dire for millions of people around the globe.
Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has urged companies there to pause all U.S. investments, which economists say could have a major impact on America's tech industry.
Brazil's Congress unanimously passed a reciprocity bill.
Aprovado.
That will allow the government to retaliate against any country or trade bloc that imposes tariffs on Brazilian goods. Lawmakers there made fiery speeches slamming interference in their economy.
Britain's prime minister called the tariffs the beginning of a new era. And Australia's prime minister, Anthony Albanese, was blunt.
The administration's tariffs have no basis in logic, and they go against the basis of our two nations' partnership. This is not the act of a friend.
Leaders of Britain, Canada, Mexico, and a host of other countries also condemned the tariffs. Even sub-Antarctic islands uninhabited by humans were slapped with 10% tariffs in yesterday's announcement.
This all could prove very disruptive to a global trade system that has been in place for a long time. So we start today's show with some big questions. Are we witnessing the dismantling of that system? And if we are, what might replace it? Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group, an international consulting firm. Here is how he described the global trade system that's been in place for decades.
In terms of the post-war consensus, it was the United States driving globalization and supporting U.S.-led multilateral institutions, the Bretton Woods so-called institutions, IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, that meant that we wanted low tariffs, free trade, and people and goods and ideas and services and capital moving faster and faster and more efficiently across borders all over the world. And the idea was that that was driving an incredible amount of economic growth and opportunity.
The U.S. is now breaking with America's trade policy in a way we haven't seen in more than a century. Can you talk to me about exactly what is the Trump administration's approach and what are the norms and precedents that are being thrown to the wayside here?
Well, first, it's been coming for quite some time. You've had a lot of Americans feeling like, well, maybe the U.S. economy as a whole is doing well. Maybe the stock market's doing really well. But I'm not doing very well. The middle class is hollowing out. The working class is hollowing out. You know, my job has been exported. Who's taking care of me? And certainly U.S. as one of the most unequal societies economically among all the advanced industrial democracies led to a bunch of Americans voting against free trade.
President Trump has been talking a lot about putting a tariff wall around the United States and using tariffs to rebalance the global economy towards America. More capital investment in the United States, more support for labor and working class and middle class in the United States. And if that means that other countries are going to have to pay a lot of money to get goods into the U.S., so be it.
So who gets a leg up now or stands to take advantage of this new playing field as the U.S. is moving out of what we could have called the center of this post-war economic order?
Well, there are some economies that aren't being hit as badly. I mean, certainly the UK, for example, is a winner compared to Europe. Mexico and Canada will eventually, through a lot of pain, I think, see a revised U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. But, the way you phrase that question implies that there are going to be winners. And, the global economy is going to grow less. Costs of goods are going to go up. There's going to be a lot more sand, grit in the system. So, okay, accountants will do much better. Lawyers will do much better. Political scientists will do much better. The global economy is going to perform a lot worse. And that means Americans, but it also means everybody else. This is not an environment where overall you're looking at winners. This is going to be a place where the costs are going to be spread out very broadly and for a long time.
Many economists today and even yesterday were taking issue with how President Trump's team calculated what he calls these reciprocal tariffs. Can you explain those calculations, how they arrived at the numbers of how much other countries were taxing U.S. goods, and help us understand if that's a good way to look at it?
I was a little shocked by that. I mean, I'm watching this real time, and I see that the Trump announcements of the numbers, the actual numbers, are so much higher than the tariffs that those other countries apply on the United States. And he's been talking for months about the need for reciprocal tariffs. Reciprocal tariffs means whatever they tariff you, you tariff them. That's not what's happening at all. So we're like, well, where did he get these numbers from? These are obviously made up numbers. It turns out that what he's looking at is the level of trade surplus that other countries are running compared to the United States. And he put a tariff measure in place. The reciprocity would reflect what you would need to tariff in order to get that trade relationship in balance, and then did 50% of that. So, I mean, imagine like a country like Lesotho. Why are they running a trade surplus with the U.S.? Because their people can't afford to buy American goods.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And by the way, for those countries that run a trade deficit against the U.S., reciprocity doesn't mean that they don't actually see higher tariffs or that the Americans bring them down. No. In this case, reciprocity is that the Americans are just going to put 10% across the board tariff on you just because. So this is it's pretty dramatic.
So these new tariffs from the U.S. does not necessarily mean that the rest of the world can't still pursue a more inclusive, sustainable economy that allows for global growth. New trade relationships that are less dependent on the U.S. might emerge. What are some of the scenarios that you think are realistic unfolding now here in the global economy?
Well, there's going to be a lot of hedging in the near term. Those economies that can de-risk away from the United States to save money, to avoid tariffs, will. I've had many European leaders call me, many other leaders from the Global South call me, talking about de-risking from the United States. But let's keep in mind, the U.S. is the largest economy in the world. It has the largest military in the world, and that military is essential for a lot of countries that are aligned with it. The U.S. also has the hyperscalers for technology and AI. Those are not substitutable by other countries. So there are a lot of places where the U.S. relationship will be very sticky. There's a lot of places where U.S. market power will really matter. And so you'll also see countries that will try very hard to cut deals and try very hard to increase investment and manufacturing and the like inside the United States, despite the cost.
Ian Bremmer is the president of Eurasia Group. We'll hear how Asia is reacting to steep tariffs later on in the show.
Tren de Aragua is a Venezuelan gang that has been coming up a lot lately in the news. President Trump has deported hundreds of alleged members of the gang to a prison in El Salvador. But critics are saying that the gang is being used as a pretext for taking drastic measures against immigrants, no questions asked. The World's Tibisay Isaiah takes a closer look at Tren de Aragua, its history, and what it has to do with the deportation of Venezuelans happening now.
In September of 2023, thousands of soldiers and police officers raided a violent prison in Venezuela called Tocorón in the coastal state of Aragua. What they found there is wild. A nightclub, illegal drug shops, swimming pools, a professional baseball field, children's playgrounds, and a zoo with monkeys and flamingos. Rona Rizquez is a Venezuelan journalist who has been able to infiltrate the prison. She says it looked like a city with hundreds of relatives of the inmates, including children, also living there. This prison is the birthplace of Tren de Aragua, Venezuela's largest homegrown criminal organization. Rizquez says the Tocorón prison was essentially run by criminals with the complicity of Venezuelan authorities. Initially, the leaders of the prison would make money by extorting other inmates, but they quickly found a much more profitable business.
By exploiting and piggybacking off the Venezuelan migrants that fled the country in their millions.
Chris Dalby is a Latin America security analyst who's writing a book about Tren de Aragua. He says the gang first established operations in several South American countries where Venezuelan migrants were moving to or passing through.
They were able to rapidly generate billions of dollars in income by exploiting the migrants, by submitting them to kidnapping, extortion, sexual trafficking, while still being based at that prison in Tocorón.
In recent years, many Venezuelans started to migrate to the United States and settled in cities like Denver, Chicago, or New York. With them arrived a small number of Tren de Aragua members who got a lot of attention in the media, especially during the presidential campaign. Chris Dalby says the gang's reputation grew more quickly than its actual presence in the U.S.
There are certainly Tren de Aragua members in the United States. They are far fewer and far less organized than the current government in the U.S. has claimed.
The Trump administration recently labeled the gang as a foreign terrorist group. And a few weeks ago, it sent 240 Venezuelans to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, accusing them of being part of Tren de Aragua. But the administration has not released enough evidence about the affiliation of these people with the gang. And it even said in a court declaration that while some of those expelled have criminal records in the U.S., many do not. Chris Dalby says it's very likely that many of the deportees are not gang members.
I have researched every single arrest claimed to be of a Tren de Aragua person and have found pathetically little justification for almost any of it.
In the small city of Capacho in western Venezuela, residents are outraged by what happened to Andri Hernandez. He's a makeup artist who grew up there and decided to emigrate to the U.S. last year. He was taken into custody right after he arrived and has now been deported to El Salvador. Last week in his hometown, hundreds of people gathered to pray for his release.
Que me lo suelte, que ese muchacho no es del Tren de Aragua, es un muchacho sano, es un muchacho de hogar.
His mother, Alexia Felix, told me her son has always been a good kid and that he was targeted by immigration officials because of his tattoos. He has two crowns on his wrists to memorialize the Three Kings celebration in his hometown, in which he participated as an actor for many years. Several other Venezuelans have reported being targeted as Tren de Aragua members because of their tattoos. But experts say Tren de Aragua members don't wear tattoos of any sort. Now, Hernandez and hundreds of other Venezuelan detainees are left in the dark about their fate in a penal system widely condemned for human rights abuses. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban announced today that his country is done with the International Criminal Court. He described the ICC as a political court because of its actions against Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu attended the Budapest press conference.
The ICC has an active arrest warrant against the Israeli leader that alleges Israel's military actions in Gaza amount to war crimes. Orban has called those allegations outrageously impudent, and he's ignored the warrant and refused to arrest Netanyahu. The country's withdrawal from the ICC could take a year or more to complete.
Ahead this hour, we'll look at Israel's attacks overnight and today on neighboring Syria. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A chunk of ice the size of Chicago broke off the Antarctic coast in January, revealing a surprising abundance of life living far below it. Patricia Eschetti was on a research ship nearby. She's a deep sea ecologist at the University of Aveiro in Portugal.
So we basically decided in the moment that we had to go there and see how the seafloor looks like, because we knew that it was a very unique opportunity. It's something that researchers have been trying to figure out, how the ecosystems, how the seafloor looks like under the ice shelves. So it was an opportunity to actually see how it looked like.
So you steamed to the sea, and I know you sent some uncrewed gliders down to the seafloor, and you found a lot of life down there as deep as 4,000 feet. What exactly did you find?
Well, we were surprised of finding very diverse and very rich ecosystems down there. Of course, there were areas more or less empty, but we really found areas with very rich ecosystems, with sponges, big corals, a lot of animals living on the corals and around the sponges and the corals, like sea stars and brittle stars and some octopus and crabs. It was like a really surprisingly diverse type of environment.
And why was it so surprising to find all that life down there?
There has been previous studies in which researchers drill a hole in an ice shelf and be able to see what is around. And there's with different results, so some found not much living there, other found indications there could be a rich ecosystem down there. But the truth is that in a normal setting, you will have photosynthesis happening in the surface, and that food that is produced on the surface will make its way eventually to the seafloor, feeding the ecosystems, which is something that cannot happen when you have several hundreds of feet of ice on the surface, kind of hindering that photosynthesis, all that process to happen. And we will be expecting kind of like an impoverished ecosystem, because the food making its way from outside the ice shelf all the way in will not allow that much food to get there. So we're expecting some life, but not what we found.
So what are your working theories about how so much life is being sustained in a place that scientists thought there wouldn't be that much life?
Well, that's one of the big questions that we have now. We are very much interested in actually study what processes and what mechanisms make that possible. Of course, the food needs to come from somewhere else through the currents. But exactly how it's happening, that's something we need to figure out now.
So this huge chunk of ice has now started drifting away from the ice sheet in the Antarctic continent. Is that expected to disrupt or otherwise impact the deep sea ecosystems you've just found down there?
That's a very good question. And that's something that also we need to study from now. That's one of our big questions. It's going to be very important to follow up and see what's going to happen. Because in a scenario where the Antarctica is losing ice year by year, this will continue to happen. So we have now a baseline of how an ecosystem or how the communities live under the ice shelves and how they are going to continue changing with the retreat of the ice in the Antarctica. That's a very important question to ask, how the ecosystem is going to react to all those changes.
Patricia Eschetti is a deep-sea ecologist at the University of Aveiro in Portugal.
After India and the United States, Indonesia is the most populous democracy on Earth. Indonesia also has a dark history of military rule, which only ended in the late 1990s through a mass uprising. And now there's a new law that's allowing military officials back into the government. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, some are worried that this move is going to push Indonesia in the wrong direction.
Indonesia's president has a thing for combat boots and fatigues. We're all one big Indonesian family, says President Prabowo Subianto, giving a speech in full camo, as he likes to do. You might think the civilian leader of a country haunted by military rule would stick to a suit and tie, but not Prabowo.
If you understand, Prabowo does not surprise.
Beni Suketas is an Indonesian military expert with the Merapi Group, a political consultancy. He says Prabowo has a general's mindset through and through. Prabowo was a special forces commander under a long-running U.S.-backed Indonesian dictatorship. Suketas worries the strongman style is returning.
We are back to the old days.
Back to the old days, he says. In Indonesia, there's supposed to be a thick membrane between the military and politics, but that was breached last week. Parliament changed the law to allow active duty military brass to take over roles that were reserved for civilians. Uniformed officers are now cleared to take key jobs like attorney general and roles in the executive branch. Researcher Andreas Harsono with Human Rights Watch says this will make Indonesia more authoritarian and more poorly run.
It is not fair. The military is not trained to manage political parties, to do education, to do whatever.
He says putting generals in these posts also means that if they commit crimes, they can skip civilian trials and instead face army tribunals that are more lenient.
Whether you steal, whether you corrupt, that officer will be charged in the military system.
Indonesia is a tough place to govern. It's a string of tropical islands covering a distance more vast than the mainland U.S. It's filled with many ethnic groups, many languages, and many political factions. To impose order, Indonesia's former dictatorship from the 60s to the 90s oversaw the killings of up to a million dissidents. And as an army general back then, Prabowo went after pro-democracy activists with a vengeance. Now 73, Prabowo has reinvented himself as a loving but stern grandpa.
My people must be safe. My people must not be hungry. My people must have a good life. That is the dream of every patriot of every country in the world.
That's Prabowo speaking last year, just after he won his first election. He says the fact that Indonesians chose him to lead proves they're not that worried he'll turn into a tyrant.
Where is the concern about democracy? The concern about democracy is, I think, made up by some people in the press.
Yohannes Suleiman is a political scholar at General Ahmad Yani University in Indonesia. He says, yes, Prabowo can be hard-headed, but he isn't trying to wipe out democracy.
He's not stupid. He understands that people like democracy. He understands public opinion.
Public opinion is Prabowo is still popular, according to polls. Professor Suleiman's real worry is the Indonesian military. If the president whets its appetite, it might crave even more power.
It is a slippery slope. You give the military an inch, they will take a mile.
People's tolerance for Prabowo dressing in camo and remilitarizing the government may hinge on the economy. That's what he ran on, bringing a soldier's zeal to generating good jobs, modernizing the country beyond factory work and extracting minerals. That'll be tough, though. Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch says people won't put up with both a bad economy and an overreaching military.
If the economy is getting bad, it might be the end. The end of accepting the military in politics.
On that front, Prabowo has some work to do. Indonesia's stock market is in free fall, and its currency sank to one of its lowest values since 1998. That's the year street protest led to the end of dictatorship. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Asian economies are among the major targets of President Trump's current tariff spree. 24% on Japanese imports, 25% on South Korea, and an added 34% on goods from China. That's on top of the 20% tariffs already in place on Chinese goods before yesterday. The move is not altogether unexpected, though, and it appears to be bringing those three nations, not known for working together, into some sort of alignment. David Steinberg teaches political economy at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University.
I think these countries are facing a really difficult strategic dilemma about how they want to respond, whether they want to offer the United States concessions and try and get those tariffs on their own country lower, or if they want to work together to try and find alternatives to the U.S. market. And I think the incentives are also somewhat different between China, seen as, you know, Trump's major bogeyman and an adversary of the United States on the one hand, and Japan and South Korea on the other, who as allies, I think, have some options available to them that are probably not available to China.
So let's talk about China then. What do you expect to be the consequences of these additional and quite hefty tariffs on the Chinese economy?
Yeah, there's no doubt this will be bad news for the Chinese economy. Major export sectors like consumer electronics, textiles, and clothing are going to be hurt. And the coastal regions in China where they're located are going to be hurt as well. Now, China's been here before. They've seen tariffs in place since about 2018. And so the Chinese economy is not quite as dependent on the United States as it once was. But there's no doubt that going up to an effective tariff rate that some people are estimating to now be over 70% on China is going to make it extremely difficult for China to export to the United States. So it's a pretty poor outlook for them.
I mean, the tariffs could not have come as a total surprise to Beijing. They've been telegraphed by Trump for months. What has China been doing in the background preparing for the impact of these tariffs? Like a retaliation planning or something else?
I think there is probably a three-pronged strategy here. So the first is there's going to be some sort of retaliation, what Beijing is calling resolute countermeasures, which is going to involve counter-tariffs on China, likely targeted at politically strategic industries in the United States like agriculture, which are predominantly located in Republican districts, blacklisting and investigating important U.S. companies to make it more difficult for U.S. firms to do business in China. They're also likely to impose export controls on critical minerals, the types of things that the United States actually wants to buy from China. I think the second, which we've seen already, is efforts to try and diversify away from the United States to reduce reliance on the U.S. market by finding other countries to be their customers to replace those U.S. goods. And we've seen them trying to work with Japan and Korea in particular to coordinate a response against the U.S. Now, Japan and Korea don't seem quite as enthusiastic yet anyway, but that seems to be part of the strategy. And I think the third piece that maybe has been overlooked is I think there's going to be a broader effort in China to just move inwards, to shift inwards, and to become less reliant on international trade in general. I think a major lesson that China took back in 2018 was that there are risks involved in becoming dependent on the international economy, and the international trading system is no longer reliable. And while China might try and replace the U.S., seen as the sort of least reliable trading partner, I think the broader lesson for China and for other countries will be that you expose yourself to a bunch of political and economic risks when you rely on other countries, and there's going to be an incentive to just shift inwards and do what Xi Jinping has already been describing for a number of years now as an effort to make China more self-reliant.
I mean, the idea of China becoming less reliant on international trade, that seems odd because international trade has been such a huge boon for China. It's changed the country, right?
Absolutely correct. There's been no country in this century who's benefited more from international trade than China. But when the international trading system is no longer seen as something that is hospitable for you, I think it is out of perceived necessity, not out of something that they themselves view as the best path forward for their economy.
So while we wait to see what happens with this kind of trilateral free trade agreement idea between China, Japan, and South Korea, let's look at Japan and South Korea because they're being slapped with 24 and 25% tariffs respectively. What do you see happening to those economies as a result?
There is no doubt that those economies will also be affected. You know, South Korea in particular is pretty dependent on exports to the United States. I think they are likely to take more of a wait-and-see approach than China here. They have a bit of a different strategic dilemma than China to an extent. I think they might think that the best path forward is to at least try to offer concessions to the Trump administration in the hopes that it will allow tariffs on Japanese and South Korean goods to go down and try and get that to work. I think that's much less of an attractive option for China. China knows that they're not likely to get preferential treatment from the United States. And so I think they will be moving along probably a twin path of trying to work with the Trump administration to convince them that they should get preferential treatment, while at the same time, much like China is doing, try to find new sources of business for their products and also working to diversify. So I would see Japan and South Korea as trying to simultaneously play China and the United States off of one another and cautiously figure out which path is going to work best for them.
David Steinberg teaches political economy at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University.
Israel launched another attack near Syria's capital, Damascus, today. That's according to Syrian TV. It follows a series of attacks Israel launched on Syria yesterday. One strike on the city of Nawa in southern Syria killed 9 people. Israel says it's targeting the former regime's military infrastructure, but the attacks come just as a new government is coming together in Syria. Kutaiba Itilbi is a Syrian political analyst in Washington.
there has been multiple airstrikes, mostly focusing on Hama military airport in central Syria and some on the outskirts of the T4 military base. It's one of Syria's largest military bases in near Palmyra in central Syria as well. Those attacks were followed by on-the-ground advancement in southern Syria beyond the demilitarized zone towards the towns of Tesil and Nawa in southern Syria. Following, of course, Israeli incursions, there was local mobilization to try to stop Israeli forces from advancing, which led to those confrontations, leading to the killing of 9 Syrians by Israeli forces who advanced into those towns.
So Syria mobilized ground forces. It does not have an air force or anti-aircraft capabilities, correct? So there was little it could do about it can do about airstrikes from Israel?
Correct. But I want to highlight here that it wasn't actually the government who mobilized. It was actually locals in those towns who really mobilized themselves to push back against Israeli incursion. I think it's notable to mention here kind of the response that is coming from the Syrian government, which in a sense, it is not trying to escalate militarily at any point. It continues to say that, you know, they're not in the business of creating any security risks for any of Syria's neighbors. They don't want to go into any conflict. So in a sense, the Syrian government continues to try to de-escalate the situation with Israel. I think the biggest question, especially after last night, is for how long can the government truly contain public pressure right now inside Syria, which largely is asking for a response for those continued Israeli aggressions and attacks on Syrian citizens and on Syrian soil.
But what is Israel's stated reasoning for these attacks?
I mean, Israel has been saying a mix of things. I think on one hand that occupying the demilitarized zone in this state of vacuum in Syria is necessary to protect the security of Israel. A second reason, they said that they don't trust the new leadership in Syria. In his visit to Washington, Netanyahu told U.S. officials that their vision is that Syria and Turkey will build an army that will invade Israel in 20 years and create another October 7th. But from security perspective, you know, all of the actions that Netanyahu is doing in Syria do not make sense. It is creating more aggression from Syrians towards Israel, which is not helpful on the long term. But even in terms of security and military goals, there is no need for Israel to go beyond what it is already occupying in the Golan Heights, especially that the country has just left 14 years of civil war that really left nothing in state capabilities to threaten anyone in the region.
This all comes as Syria and Turkey are in talks to establish a defense pact. And Israeli authorities have expressed concern about Turkey potentially establishing military bases inside Syria. Are last night's attacks being seen as a warning to Turkey?
I mean, some of them are. There were definitely statements by some Israeli officials about that. I think the main issue here is that the Israeli actions in Syria are driving the Syrian government to go set up a military cooperation with Turkey, because that is the only option left for the Syrian government to protect its sovereignty, to stop Israeli aggression by seeking basically military empowerment. I think Turkey feels threatened by Israeli, you know, unlimited aggression in the region and by its free hand in targeting anything and everything in the region. So Turkey feels the pressure to make sure that, you know, there is at least like this buffer zone, or that, you know, Turkey's interest or, you know, future security is protected from any basically potential military threat coming from Israel. The main issue here is that Israel is really creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is creating the security risk that it claims it's trying to defend against.
And what specifically is Syria hoping to gain with this closer defense alliance to Ankara? Is it basically air forces?
The main collaboration would be around setting up air defense systems across the country that would prevent Israeli air force basically from violating Syria's sovereignty and just bombing military bases or Syria's military capabilities across the country. That is the main stated and, like, you know, cleared goal by Damascus.
Kutaiba Itilby is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He joined us from Washington.
In a rare bipartisan move this week, a group of U.S. senators introduced a bill to slap Russia with additional economic sanctions, just as peace talks between the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine appear to have stalled. Far away from the negotiating table, though, Russia aerial attacks continue, and Ukrainians still fear for their lives. When it comes to the fight on the front lines, there are troops, medics, but also military chaplains who often have to travel to those dangerous areas for their work. From Kyiv, The World's Daniel Offman reported this story.
In the outskirts of Kyiv, a group of clergymen meet for a training session run by the Taras Shevchenko University Military Institute. The atmosphere is light and jovial, but the subject matter is serious. The men here are training to become military chaplains. This is Maxim Kravchuk, a chaplain instructor and a priest in the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. He says that when you become a chaplain, you serve everyone, including those who aren't religious. Kravchuk explains that to become a chaplain, you must already be a member of the clergy. Then when you complete a six-week course, you become an officer in Ukraine's military chaplaincy service. Kravchuk says that soon after the full-scale invasion, he decided to join the military. The military chaplaincy service was the best of both worlds. He would continue his service as a priest, but within the military. One of the students here is Konstantin Pantelei, a priest in Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church. Pantelei says that part of his role is talking with soldiers about their future and helping them understand what they're fighting for.
It's very important to understand how to feel themselves about enemies. We don't like to kill them, but it is a daily work, and we still must remain ourselves, to remain Christians, to remain people, to remain human.
Pantelei says he prays for the enemy, for them to turn away and go home. Stepan Sus is a bishop in Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church. He says that the role of religious leaders in Ukraine is even more important today as an antidote to some of the messages coming from Moscow. The head of the Russian Orthodox Church there has endorsed the invasion.
They are thinking that they have special task through Ukrainians to save the world from the sins, from the evil, what is very dangerous. Because all them, all our enemies, they're using the Christian values to justify their crimes.
Sus was a military chaplain for 5 years before Russia's invasion, and he studied the discipline in academic settings. He says the most important task for a chaplain is
to be present when the soldiers are facing difficulties in their lives, some crisis or family troubles. They are looking for some person to whom they can talk about these difficulties. And this person is, for them, first of all, the chaplain.
Sus says a chaplain is someone to consult with, a calming presence in a very stressful environment. Rabbi David Millman also joined after Russia's full-scale invasion. He says he has a wide array of responsibilities as a Jewish chaplain, starting with religious services, providing soldiers with kosher food, being with them on holidays, and making sure officers accommodate religious needs when possible. Communicating with military families, he says, is also a big part of the job.
Мы же понимаем, что произошло тотальное разделение семей.
Millman says the war has led to a huge separation of families. He says there are many cases where men are serving in the military and their families are abroad. He says not everyone is capable of maintaining long-distance relationships, so chaplains do what they can to help families navigate this crisis. Millman also says that there are men who've been drafted against their will. He says, for those who are in the army against their will, we try to help them get non-combat roles, to keep them away from the front lines. Millman says that for him, being a chaplain represents his patriotism and his faith. Millman says, what's the point of learning the Bible and not putting it into action? There's a saying that a person who saves a life saves an entire world.
Your presence must be not only yours, but you have to carry God into the hell of war.
That's Andriy Zelensky, a priest with Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church. He's also chief deputy in Ukraine's military chaplaincy service. Zelensky describes war as a place where people are on the edge of humanity, a place where order turns into chaos. In this space, Zelensky says the chaplain reminds soldiers of the best human values, like truth, justice, and beauty.
This is a very unique capacity of a human being to be able to see the beauty in the hell of a war makes you stronger than this hell. And beauty is everywhere.
In the face of war, Zelensky says this task is especially challenging. Soldiers see the worst of humanity and often dehumanize their enemy.
We can understand and we have to heal, because dehumanizing is, of course, the practice that hurts not only the dignity of a human being who is being dehumanized, but the dignity of a human being who is dehumanizing.
For Zelensky, that's what Ukrainian victory can look like, a future where Ukrainian soldiers heal from this war, knowing that they've preserved their human values with dignity. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Almost 2 years ago in Sudan, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces swept into the capital Khartoum in a surprise attack. Sudan's National Army fought back, but what ensued was a protracted and bloody stalemate. Last week, the Sudanese armed forces drove the RSF out of Khartoum. The RSF have lost, but the capital city has been destroyed in the fighting. Khartoum was home for Hamid Khalafola. He's now a PhD candidate at the University of Manchester in the UK, previously a fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. I asked him how he's kept an eye on Khartoum from afar.
Throughout the past 2 years, it was quite difficult because very little videos and photos were coming out of Khartoum. That is because of the telecommunications blackout over the past 2 years, but also because the continuous targeting of the rapid support forces and also the military against human rights defenders and trying to shed light on what has been happening inside Khartoum. But throughout this, there was a way every now and then to get some news from people on the ground, particularly through the emergency response rooms, the grassroots humanitarian initiative that was responding to the catastrophe, the humanitarian catastrophe on the ground. They were able to share news of, you know, what's missing, how they are surviving. Through that, they were also sharing updates from the ground in terms of the level of destruction. Khartoum is nothing that like what we have seen before, or the Khartoum that we left in April 2023. The way the city is damaged is unimaginable.
And give us a picture, if you would, Hamid, before the war, when you lived in Khartoum. What was it like? Help us picture it.
The ecosystem of Khartoum and how it operates massively changed as a result of the revolution in 2018-2019. There was continuous political life and civic spaces were thriving and civil politics were thriving in so many ways. Until the coup happened, the military coup orchestrated by the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces in 2021, when it happened, it tried to change that dynamic. However, until the war broke out in Khartoum in April 2023, you could still see remnants of that thriving political life. Despite military oppression, there was still a lot of resistance. You would go to Khartoum, you would see weekly protests and so on. That has completely changed, obviously, after the war started.
And I mean, within that debate between the civilians and the National Army, was there still a nightlife? Were there concerts? Like, could you go to restaurants?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There was still very much vibing social life happening. In fact, what Khartoum residents would describe continuously as how the war broke out in Ramadan in 2023 and how that Ramadan in particular was very different, where there were a lot of events happening despite the difficulties imposed by the military coup. There were a lot of events happening, there were a lot of social life, concerts, a lot of people when the war broke out on the very early hours of April 15th were coming back from concerts actually and from some Ramadan events. In a way, people would say it felt like Khartoum was saying goodbye.
And once war broke out between the RSF and the National Army, it scuppered any existent nightlife in Khartoum. I'm wondering, Hamid, what you would point to as the significant milestones since then in the destruction? Like, are there moments you can now see in retrospect that were important?
To many people, I think seeing the level of destruction of the presidential palace, not only for its historical kind of value and so on, but also because for the past 4 years or so on before the war broke out, there were weekly protests where people were marching towards that palace.
It is still early, but what are you hearing from people displaced from Khartoum about possible plans to return and take stock?
Thousands have returned to Khartoum, particularly from Egypt and from other states. And that is very understandable that these people have been displaced for 2 years now. People have been either, you know, renting houses in other states or in Cairo or in other places in Egypt, but without any sort of income because all their savings, they either lost or they have used all of them. They've exhausted all their resources and they needed just to go back.
I mean, for some Sudanese, pushing the rapid support forces out of Khartoum is an exciting development, but I can't help but wonder how some must be grieving for the city they've lost and the Herculean efforts it'll now take to rebuild.
Absolutely. I think many, even those who, you know, are inside Khartoum and have been suffering for the past 2 years and were very relieved to see the rapid support forces withdraw, they were also recognizing that it's very much a bittersweet moment because regardless of what comes next and some sense of order restored in Khartoum, seeing everything that was lost over the past 2 years, I think no victory would compensate for that or make them forget about what they've lost and what they've suffered for the past 2 years.
Hamid Khalafola is a former non-resident fellow for the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy.
Let's wind things down today on a lighter note with the wonder of travel and the feeling you get sometimes in new places of noticing every single little detail. That's exactly the feeling producer Phil Corbett captured one particular evening in Cusco, Peru.
There was a lightning storm in the river valley, and the gibbous moon crested above the mountain, but not before lighting a crown like heaven itself was tucked away right on top. I laid back in the field, everyone else restless in their tents, and I looked at the suns between the patches of clouds. I looked at the suns illuminating somewhere else, and I felt small. The lightning was silent. Dusk in Cusco, Peru. I walked up a hill to the bell tower. The clouds faded to blue, and I sat on a bench in the courtyard of the church. The sound of high-pitched three-wheeled moto taxi horns echoed up through the cobbled streets and slid back down off the clay roof tiles, bouncing straight home into the taxi steering wheels so the drivers could hit the center and honk them right back out again, aiming somewhere new. And then the bell tower above the city erupted. But it wasn't a bell. It was a choir, or a recording of a choir singing so that the next town over could listen in. The voices ascended. The choir was booming.
This is part of a series called Postcards from the Wind, produced by Phil Corbett. Hear more stories at thewind.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.